Thank you, Dharma and Cassidy. Good morning, friends. As Dharma said, the scripture is on pages 7 and 8 in the New Testament section of the Pew Bible, if you want to follow along. And I'm going to read verses 1 through 6 and then skip to verses 16 through 18. So we will skip over, we'll actually skip over the Lord's Prayer, which Cassidy has already read for us this morning. So Matthew chapter 6, verses 1 through 6 and 16 through 18. Beware of practicing your righteousness before men and women and all people to be noticed by them. Otherwise, you have no reward with your Father who is in heaven. So when you give to the poor, do not sound a trumpet before you as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, so that they may be honored by men. Truly, I say to you, they have their reward in full. But when you give to the poor, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your giving will be in secret. And your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. When you pray, you are not to be like the hypocrites, for they love to stand and pray in the synagogues and on the street corners so that they may be seen by others. Truly, I say to you, they have their reward in full. But you, when you pray, go into your inner room, close your door, and pray to your Father who is in secret. And your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. Whenever you fast, do not put on a gloomy face as the hypocrites do, for they neglect their appearance so that they will be noticed by others when they are fasting. Truly, I say to you, they have their reward in full. But you, when you fast, anoint your head and wash your face so that your fasting will not be noticed by others, but by your Father who is in secret. And your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. All right, we'll let Sarah take whoever wants, whichever children want to go downstairs. The rest of you, maybe not so much. Probably most of you are familiar with the phrase conspicuous consumption. You've heard of this? The idea has been around for a while. It was first identified by a man named Thorsten Veblen, who was an American sociologist and economist, who around the turn of the 20th century wrote a book in which he identified and examined the way that the upper classes at the time, and remember this was the Gilded Age, the 1890s, the upper classes spent lavishly on goods and services as a way of demonstrating their social status. If you had it, you had to flaunt it. Other sociologists ran with this idea throughout the 20th century. There's been lots of additional research and theorizing that is related to this idea of conspicuous consumption. And of course, what happened in the United States, especially after World War II, is that material prosperity increased significantly. So conspicuous consumption became a way of life for many middle class and even poor Americans by the 1960s. And it's no surprise that it should be no surprise to any of us, that this phenomenon is still with us. In the age of the Hummer and the iPhone and the towers built by our 45th president. And of course, it goes much further back in human history than the 20th or the 19th century. It goes back quite a ways. The spirit against which Jesus' words here warn us is the spirit of conspicuousness. In fact, there is a companion idea to conspicuous consumption that relates to at least one of the practices that Jesus addresses in what he says in Matthew 6. There is a contemporary sociologist named Patrick West who has identified what he calls conspicuous compassion. Conspicuous compassion, which is the use of high-profile charitable donations to enhance one's social prestige in the same way that people used to spend lavishly upon things and on services. Some folks now spend lavishly on giving when that is meant to be more an enhancement of their own status than anything else. Money garners status in many ways. Again, I'm not telling you anything you don't already know, including when we give it away rather than spending it on ourselves. Even in a seemingly magnanimous act, there can be something self-promoting. And in fact, West's work, this fellow Patrick West, focuses on the way that some acts of compassion, the conspicuous kind, in fact mitigate the good that they are meant to accomplish. So it might be better for them not to have been done at all. So we might say that Jesus' first warning here in today's passage is against conspicuous compassion. When you give, do not sound a trumpet before you, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, so that they may be honored by others. And the counsel is similar for the other two actions as well, for prayer and for fasting. Don't do what the hypocrites do. So one of the questions as we look at this passage is, who were the hypocrites? And I think it is difficult to know whether or not Jesus was here speaking against an actual practice of Jewish people in his day and age, or whether he's speaking polemically, whether he's sort of, with some degree of exaggeration, he's speaking to cast his argument in stark terms, to indict practices that might not have been quite as extreme as what he is describing here, but still might have had an intent of self-promotion or self-gratification behind them, rather than of true devotion to God. What we do know is that Jesus' words relate not just to Jewish culture or practice in the first century, but also to the overall culture, the prevailing culture of the Roman Empire, where honor and patronage were very important. If you were a person of means, it was expected that you would give a certain amount to certain people. And oftentimes, they were guests in your household or they were members of your household themselves. But they might also have been people in need, people who actually had need of alms. And that was all part of what was required of someone of means. It was required that you you patronized others, and in so doing, you would be honored yourself. So you can see that in this overall culture of honor and patronage, folks in the synagogues, faithful Jews, may also have bought into public displays of charity. And the practices that Jesus mentions here, giving, prayer, and fasting, are practices that perhaps we don't always think of as integral spiritual practices today. Some of us may practice them, some of us may not. You may not see your giving as a spiritual discipline, but it can be. You may not fast. Many Christians do, but many don't. I hope that we all pray. But in Jesus' time, these three practices were, I think, probably much more common among Jews that would have participated in the synagogue, faithful Jews, than necessarily they are for Christians today. So he is not giving here laws. He is not saying you have to fast and you have to pray and you have to give. But he is speaking to the context in which he lived and breathed as to how practices like this can actually be obstacles in the life of faithful people with their God, rather than things that facilitate that life. So with us, they can be things that facilitate our life with God, or they can be obstacles. The reason that I chose to read this passage today is that this coming Wednesday is the beginning of the season known to much of the Christian tradition as Lent. And most of you know that Lent is the 40-day period prior to Easter Sunday. The length of 40 days is meant to correspond to the period that Jesus spent in the wilderness, in a period of prayer and also of testing or temptation. The gospel writers tell us that he fasted and he was tested by the adversary. So Lent is a season of preparation. Jesus' time in the wilderness was a one-time preparation for ministry. It happens at the very beginning of his ministry, at least by most of the gospel writers. And for the church, remembering Jesus' wilderness experience is a way of looking towards the resurrection. It culminates with the commemoration of the events of the last weeks of Jesus' life: Jerusalem, trial, the cross, death, and then the empty tomb on Easter morning. So in church tradition, it's become a period of preparation. And fasting, prayer, and giving are all part of that. And whenever I think about, well, prior to last month, whenever I thought about Lent, I thought about fasting, because I don't know where I got that idea exactly, but it probably goes way further back than seminary for me. But knowing that Lent was a period where you were supposed to deny yourself and do without, because you were getting ready for Easter. But thankfully, I go to see a spiritual director once a month, and he's not a Quaker, so he knows more about church tradition than I do. And he reminded me that it's not just fasting, it's also giving and prayer. That all of these are Lenten disciplines. All of these are things that, by church tradition, Christians have devised through the centuries to spend time in doing in this season of preparation. Okay, now here comes the Quaker disclaimer, right? Rick, you'll hear this often enough that you should be able to do it pretty soon yourself. Quakers have always disregarded seasons and days, right? Special times of the year were rejected out of hand by the first friends. All the traditional observances of the church, the holy days, the saints' days, seasons like Lent and Advent, even the holidays like Christmas and Easter themselves that we generally celebrate today, early friends said, threw all that stuff out. That was all priestcraft, right? That was all stuff that people had made up. It wasn't in the Bible for the most part. So why do you need it? For the early friends, all of that was only unnecessary. Not only unnecessary, it was also harmful. It was stuff, again, that had accumulated and over centuries and that obscured the inward daily life, the daily reality of Christ's presence. The center of the Quaker critique of the observance of a season like Lent is that it calls for a special dedication to God at a particular time, which may then tempt us to say that we don't need to be open to God's presence at other times. If I'm going to observe this special day or season, and that observance is going to bring me closer to God, then maybe I don't need to worry about it so much before Ash Wednesday or after Easter, right? If I did my Lent stuff, I'm good the rest of the year. Because of that possibility, friends say we need to realize the sacred possibility of every day, every time, every season. In each season and in each moment, we need to be seeking out communion with God. That critique holds a great deal of power for me, and probably for a lot of you. That's why we're friends. But we also live in a different time and place than the first friends. And in our daily lives, there are many distractions. In my daily life, anyway, there's plenty of distraction. So many of them that they've become like saints' days and special observances were for the first friends. They've become stuff that obscures the daily inward reality of communion with Christ. So for me, one way to get away from all that accumulated stuff and to get more practice with spiritual discipline is to take the time to observe a season like Lent and to reconnect with Christ in that season, in the hope that I will have strengthened those muscles and I will have more ability to live in daily communion with Christ in the days that follow the special season. So this year I'm trying not to think just about fasting, but also to think about prayer and giving. And I haven't really worked out what that's going to mean for me, but I'm mentioning it today because if you really want to follow the calendar, Ash Wednesday is Wednesday. And that's the beginning of what you might think of as a season in which to strengthen your spiritual muscles in one way or another. I have to also confess to a fairly major distraction this week. which intersects with another part of Matthew chapter 6 that I just want to say a little bit about, which is Stephanie and I got burgled on Friday night. Our house got broken into. And everything's fine. Some stuff got taken. But it's ironic, or perhaps providential, that the scripture passage immediately after the one that we read a little bit earlier this morning, beginning at verse 19, Jesus says, "Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust consume, and what happens? Where thieves break in and steal. Store up for yourselves instead treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust consumes, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." So as Charles is encouraging us to tell how the Bible speaks to us, this is the Bible speaking to me today, friends. Do not store up treasures on earth. Now, to come home to your house in disarray and your valuables tossed around, I don't know how many of you have experienced it, but it's a violation. It really does not feel good. So after we cursed and cried and called the police and waited for the police to come and waited while the police checked for fingerprints that weren't there because these people wore gloves, they were pretty professional. After all of that, we reminded ourselves, we're okay, the cat's okay. In fact, the cat might have slept through the whole thing. It's just stuff. It could have been a lot worse. And then we also discovered the various small graces involved. They found our old expired passports in a desk drawer, but they didn't find the ones that were in a less obvious place. They took 3 computers and 2 tablets. Okay, treasures on earth, right? But they didn't find my e-reader, so I had something that I could type this message on this weekend. And the best part for me was that they somehow knocked our backup drive off of the sideboard in the dining room where it was sitting, for reasons that aren't worth explaining. They somehow knocked it down behind the sideboard and decided it was too much trouble to go after. So I still have most of my data. Because that's the thing that I would miss the most. It's not the computer. It's not the tablet. The spotting scope I'll miss a little bit, but we can always get another spotting scope. It's the information that was stored on that computer. It's all those accumulated emails and the sermon notes and little half-finished software projects that I never get around to completing. The photos and the music and the other media, the notes from people that I love and the notes to people that I love. That would be the real loss. And part of it is because that isn't just treasure on earth. Some of that, where it's places that I've discovered how Christ is working in your life, or where I've been able to explain to you how Christ is working in mine or in the life of the church, that's heavenly treasure as well. So I'm thankful for that particular grace that God visited upon us today, that I still have a reasonably complete backup of a lot of information that's really important and precious. Even, however, had that backup drive disappeared, there would still be a season in which I am invited to fast and pray and give in an attempt to focus on that of God and not on that of the world. If this preparation for the time known as Easter is a useful thing to you, I encourage you to explore it with me more this year.